Is this working? Yes. Reminds me of exchanging the cricket protector in country cricket when you went out. After you'd emptied the sweat out of it, it was always considered a courtesy. But thank you, Clem, for actualizing me, as they say. Saving me self-actualization. Ray, that's a wolf. It's not wherever Ray is, it's a wolf, not a coyote. You'll know, I know you've been out of Wyoming a long time, but coyotes are smaller. although people do mistake them. People who want to see wolves apparently often see coyotes and convince themselves for the rest of their lives that they saw a wolf, but it was actually a coyote. I could spend nearly all of the time allotted to me today talking about why someone should not try and write a book about the United States. Why, when you're with virtually every sentence, you're thinking, Tocqueville said it better. Why am I even attempting to write a book that after Tocqueville, or after Mark Twain, or after someone who actually knows the place, who lives there? Why am I trying to write? How dare I generalize about a place as various as this? The place is impossible to know. And it's changing. I mean, what one might have written in 2005 is not true in 2006, even if it had been true then. In any event, I did it, and it was because I think I took Sherman as my guide, you know, and I thought, well, Sherman didn't take Atlanta by sitting around wondering whether he was up to the job or contemplating any other nicety. In fact, I wish I'd taken Sherman as my example much earlier in my life instead of Karl Marx or some other loser, you know. I mean, can you imagine Karl Marx taking Atlanta? I mean, it's just... he'd wait till it happened, then he'd write about it, you know, ironically. You don't argue with a man who burned Atlanta, proposed a final solution for the Plains Indians, and called it a final solution, and as far as we can tell from the photographs, combed his hair with a bayonet. No one would argue with Sherman. So I will plunge on, as Sherman put it, without regard for the humanities of the case. A few years ago, I wrote an essay about the relationship between Australia and the US, and I called it Rabbit Syndrome, after the character in John Updike's quartet of novels, Rabbit Angstrom. Those of you who have read the Rabbit Quartet will remember that he grows fat and wealthy almost despite himself, selling Toyotas in the main. Rabbit has a good brain and he's capable of thoughts and feelings beyond his own self-interest, but he's rarely able to exercise them or to aspire to much beyond golf, Toyotas, the female pudenda, and a sunken living room. The patterns of his thinking and the shape of his life never escape the patterns and shape of hedonism and consumerism, which for most people, let's face it, define what it is to be free. Now, instead of Rabbit is Updike's metaphor for America, but he seemed to me at the time, which is 2002, more like a metaphor for Australia. I said that Rabbit exhibits, that while Australia exhibits all the symptoms of this Rabbit syndrome, the United States exhibits something much more heroic in a way, including near surfeits of genius, altruism, and civilized endeavor. We are, I suggested, the ersatz imitative rabbits, while the US is the full-blown high fructose energizer battery future rabbit. Way out in front in consumerism, celebrity culture, corn syrup, crime, carbon emissions, all the C's, but also in being the fullest expression of human freedom. In one of its many incarnations, at least, The US, it seemed to me, is an endlessly creative, confident, cool republic, the cool republic that we are not and have never been. It knows freedom in a way that we do not, and it means by freedom something that we fading Anglophones and incurable collectivists do not quite understand. Now, just to fill you in for this, for no more than this, and for just suggesting almost seriously that our interests might be better served by petitioning for inclusion in the Union, Tony Abbott and your own Christopher Pearson declared that I hated my own people, that I was un-Australian, which in those days, you'll remember, was better than being called anti-American. You could be hanged for being anti-American, but un-Australian, you're just attacked in the Australian. I only meant that we should consider taking a seat at the table. Then, if the Prime Minister thought Barack Obama was unfit to be president, or Dick Cheney thought it would be a cool thing for the Prime Minister to say, then the Prime Minister could say it without making a goat of himself. But the episode did go to show, I thought, that how oblivious to notorious historical precedent those protagonists of the culture wars appear to think that the only way to serve one's country and its alliances is to refrain from criticising them. And it always seems strange to me how the tough guys of the culture wars always seem to have a glass jaw, or thought their country had a glass jaw, as if the general population was feeble-minded and couldn't live with contradictions. That's strange, too, that those purporting to be pro-American should be averse to paradox and anything containing multitudes. But the best thing that George Miller, the filmmaker, ever said that he hoped the culture wars would end, and I wish they'd never started. I think the culture wars are the worst thing to come out of America since PowerPoint. And I'm sorry, I don't have PowerPoint tonight. If you're missing dot points, well, maybe you can find an olive pip or something in your pocket and you can use that. Forgive my sentences. Eric Hobsbawm, to name an old Marxist, wrote recently that he'd been going to the US for 40 years, yet when he stopped on the way back to Britain for a brief holiday in what he called a small, poor, linguistically incomprehensible seaside town in Portugal, he felt like he was back in civilization. That's a very common feeling. I know what he means. It's the absence in America of basic services, the belligerence of the media, the blatant inequalities, the unrestrained consumerism, the vulgarity, the parochialism, the myopia, all that. And yet when I went back to the US in 2005, I realised that it had had this weird effect on me, and it had done it for the umpteenth time. Italy has charms, and so has Sydney. For that matter, so has Tasmania. But the US has different charms. It has a different effect. I don't mean it's a better place. I only mean that there's no place on earth that even remotely approaches the experience of the United States. This was in May 2005, which was before Hurricane Katrina. George Bush was still polling in the 40s. Can you believe that? When I went back in October, he'd gone into a slide. Katrina was one of the reasons. And so was Iraq, of course. He was changing the rhetoric on Iraq, but he was consistent about one thing. He kept talking about freedom. You'll remember, he said, we have seen freedom's victory. He said freedom over and over again. Our enemies hate us for our freedoms. Now, freedom is such a cliche of American rhetoric that we tend to discount it. We take no notice when they talk about it, even though we know that Americans have died in their tens of thousands defending it. It just shows the annihilating powers of a cliché. In any case, we think it's less for freedom that they hate you and more for the hegemony. Our enemies hate us for our power and influence would have been closer to the truth. And in truth, not much would have been lost by putting it in those terms. And yet, if you travel around the surface of America by train and by car, as I did, the cliché begins to shed its carapace. Migrants with only broken English and no papers in Washington, D.C. The descendants of slaves driving battered taxis in Jackson, bitter ex-soldiers in bars, Palestinians in Los Angeles, the proprietors of struggling Midwest motels, hedge fund managers who began with nothing and now have views right across Central Park, men running scams on the highways. They'll all tell you that what they think is wrong with America, but the one thing that they think is right with America is freedom. America means freedom. And if you say to them that there are other places which are free, they will either show no interest at all, or as a barman and former Marine in San Antonio told me, oh, well, they didn't tell us that at school. And it's easy to grow impatient with American parochialism. It's a sort of standing joke. I was on a train from Fort Worth to Austin, and I was sitting next to a 20-stone Texan locomotive driver. Carbohydrate filled, you know, massive. So that the mouth had almost shrunk to nothing because there was so much steak and potatoes in there. And he asked me where I was from, as if he cared. I said, Melbourne in Australia. And he took a little while to answer, and he said, I thought you was from Drippin' Springs. And I said, no. And he said, it's about 30 miles out of Austin. It's nice out there. He said, you take the 210. And at least I think it's the 310. And he called to his friend across the aisle. He said, what? Get to Drippin' Springs. And 310, his friend called back. And 310, he said. That's right, he said. Thought so. You take the 310. They got pretty well everything out there, out in Drippin' Springs. And the fact that I'd said I came from Melbourne in Australia, it was just... It didn't matter. After a while, you get to enjoy it, you know. It's like the anonymity is marvellous. Even when you're trying to make a song and dance about where you came from, if you're stupid enough to do that, they're not interested. You learn that the parochialism actually begins with the same idea of freedom. Not the idea of it, the fact of it. Because if you think you are free and that freedom is everything, and this is the one place on earth where you're free as a person can be, then nowhere else matters. Even if you're an outcast or a prisoner or a deserter, there's a wonderful quote, Herman Brock, I don't know why he fits in, but I don't think he ever went to America, Herman, but even he, the man stripped of all values on whom all earthly compulsions press, there is no man exposed to the breath of the eternal who does not once see the star of freedom rising in the night of his isolation. And you read that and you think, it's easy to imagine all those millions of Americans incarcerated in jails, the biggest growth industry in the States, thinking, well, at least I'm free. We can't put it all down to the ignorance of other places and the freedoms and pleasures to be enjoyed in them. In fact, despite every unconscionable insult to my own social democratic sensibility, I love being in America because of the tangible sense I have when I am there that I can do whatever I want. It's like going to the races on a weekday. There's a sort of guilty pleasure in it. I can grow absurdly rich. I can hunt a wild animal, like a mountain lion, even if there's only 27 of them left. I can buy anything I want. I can harbour the most absurd ideas. I can shoot someone. I can commune with God. I can pay someone $5 an hour to drive me around or prepare my meals or walk my children in the park. I can be whomever I like and whatever I like. And I know if God wills it, as he wills everything in this world, one day I might wake up famous. And if I can do, or at least dream, all the things that it is in my nature to do or dream, I will much sooner forgive the things my country does that are not in my nature or my dreams. As I said, I know what Eric Hobsbawm means. The statistics are outrageous on income inequality, poverty, health, wages, working. I mean, you could stand in America and watch them in the Senate arguing over a minimum wage of more than $5. Ted Kennedy fighting away there saying, can't we make it $7? And they're saying, no, it'll ruin the economy if you put it up to $7. And you think, how can this really, this is bizarre. You think slavery actually hasn't quite left their consciousness, which has become quite a serious argument since I first had the thought In America, everyone's had the thought before you. That's another reason for being careful. Working conditions, crime, violence, incarceration, energy consumption, the plain ugliness of much of the urban environment, all those things are likely to make someone like Eric Hobsbawm feel that he's in an uncivilized country, even though he seems to have never left New England. And that's before you get to the political system, which some old observers will tell you is corrupted beyond repair by money and special interests. And then there's the press, for which, to be fair, Americans needn't take all responsibility. In fact, Adelaide has to take more of it than anywhere else. But the appalling, belligerent, brain-numbing media, not least, in fact, most of all, Fox News. And there's the religion, the numbers who believe in the literal truth of heaven and hell, the omnipresence of Satan in the Mosaic account of creation rather than in evolution, and in the growth and proliferation of fundamentalist churches, and the takeover of others, such as the Baptists, by right-wing theocrats. Religion is staggering once you cross the Appalachians, particularly. Mark Twain was an agnostic, if not by the end of his life, a full-blown atheist. But he believed there was a need for religion, much as Tocqueville and everyone else did, if only to maintain order. I think Twain was a bit like Winston Churchill, who said he was more of a buttress than a pillar of the church. He preferred to be outside supporting it. Twain said, you know, so long as it wasn't an established church, he liked the idea of contending Protestants, and he actually said somewhere that about 40 churches nationwide was appropriate. But in towns of less than 20,000 souls in the South and the Midwest, you'll find 140 churches. The statistics will also show that a great many Americans believe in monsters, whatever that means, aliens, as I said, Satan, and supernatural beasts, not least among them the beast of Revelation. I know I'm ignoring the worlds of Charles Schultz and Garrison Keillor and all those normal Americans, but Borges had a point when he said that when you look at American history and popular American belief, you see what we often forget. It is, in the end, America, and has something in common with the culture of the countries to the south. That read Faulkner and you begin to see what he's talking about. Read the story of the Mormons, read Cormac McCarthy, read a great many things, and there is a fabulist element to America, which I think we have trouble comprehending. It is, for instance, a country in which a very large part of the population live their religion as pretty well no one has lived it in Europe since the Middle Ages. That is to say, with the Bible alive in their minds, with Satan alive, and at war with the Lord. You can listen to radio in the Midwest of America, and there is an endless theological discussion as if the prophets of the Old Testament are still walking around Tennessee. When Katrina hit New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, we saw the bad side of the US in microcosm. And we tend to underestimate the importance of New Orleans. I mean, it is, after all, a very serious place. It's the mouth of the Mississippi. It's the biggest port. After New York and LA, it is possibly the most famous American city. But the calamitous scenes that we saw and that Americans saw and suddenly became aware of the world seeing reminded them and reminded all of us of failed states of Central or South America. That's what one of the big reports on Katrina said, and everyone read, that the response had most of the characteristics of a failed state. And in August 2005, when I went back, that's what everyone, it seemed to me, was asking. How could the greatest democracy on earth look like this, where the only thing it can do is send in the army and start shooting people before it can get, the media can get in before relief can get in? How could this happen in a developed country? And there are all sorts of answers to this, which is specific to the times we live in and the philosophies, particularly the economic philosophies that now prevail and have prevailed in America for a long time. But the more general answer, I think, is that developed actually doesn't come into it. Not in the way it comes into discussions of European countries or this country. America is a very sophisticated first world country, but it isn't developed, it seems to me, in the way that Europeans and Australians generally think of it. That's because as much as it's a developed country, it's a frontier country. It can't afford to let the frontier die. The frontier defines it still, as religion defines it still. American exceptionalism and the idea of development seem to me not to go together. So long as America sees itself as God's own country, the land that God ordained, then America won't be a developed country in the same way. The reasons I hope I can roughly explain in the next couple of minutes. It's a country in which people, in various ways, see the hand of God, it seems to me. And so long as, I mean, not all of them, you know, great numbers of them don't. But if you think of God in the life of a country, think of what God says to Job, who provideth for the raven his food when his young ones cry unto God. The answer, of course, is God provideth. That was just a trick question. God provides, meaning not the state, unless God ordains it. Not even McDonald's provideth for the raven, unless God orders it. Tocqueville said of American democracy that it keeps the people in perpetual childhood and spares them all care of thinking. That's in 1831. If you combine that view with religion, which both Tocqueville and Twain thought essential to that democracy, and you have a pretty good recipe for deep quietism and avid consumerism and possibly perpetual childhood. And yet, when you think of America now, where there's been a 12-month election campaign and millions are participating in grassroots democracy, and we have a black and a woman and a Vietnam vet who's not such a terribly bad bloke, you realise that you can't generalise. I think, however, the mistake is when you think about America, I mean, you have to think about it on its own terms. And when you think about America on its own terms, it seems to me it's a mistake to think that America is like other places. I've travelled around for months. I think I went something like 30,000 miles in America. And in the end realised that the truth of what Tocqueville called American exceptionalism, that God does live there as he lives in no other first world country. It is his chosen land. It doesn't respond to the Whig interpretation of history. It's not about progress to some higher form of society, about endless improvement. It's about an endless churn, the capitalist churn invested with divine favour. Present strident anti-liberalism will probably die down. In fact, it's already died down. The Democrats will be returned, but America will not start behaving like us as a result. And I suspect if Eric Hobsbawm went back in another 50 years, which he won't do because he's about 87 now, if he went back in 50 years, he'd find that nothing much had changed to his satisfaction. The Socialist Republic of Santa Monica will not spread much beyond its present boundaries. And in general, I'm inclined to be grateful for this. I don't think it's just Al-Qaeda that hates America's freedoms. I think a lot of the developed world is uncomfortable with them as well. And I even think that President Bush, at least in his subconscious, means this when he talks about people hating America for its freedoms. I think he means the whole rest of the world, because I think he shares the view that nowhere else in the world is as free or knows what freedom is. When I ask myself why America intrigues me and exhilarates me more than any other place, including this one, I have to say, although that's improving now, the answer comes down to this intangible, almost intangible quality of freedom. It produces bluster on Fox News and elsewhere, It produces chaos and social failure, but it also produces a quality of forthrightness and self-possession and articulateness, what Henry Adams called a bold freedom of self-assertion, a keen practical sagacity that is lacking in other places. I actually find, maybe shot on the way out, I find America blessedly free of mateship. Buddyship, yes. I don't like the buddyship. It seems to be a place without mateship, yet people are open, hospitable, and generous, and have an entirely different attitude to success. They actually delight in it. Men like Dave Letterman and Larry King actually grow teeth so they can delight in people's success. That is why Americans who can afford them have their teeth fixed so they can delight in success. The success of their own success, the success of their children, but also the success of others. It is an amazing difference. American freedom also produces, of course, the most astonishing scientific and cultural achievement. I remember driving through New Mexico one day, and on this one day, a rocket was to be launched to Pluto. This in a country that believes God made Pluto. I don't know what day he made Pluto. I don't know why he made Pluto. And the same day as they were launching a rocket to Pluto, it was going to take about 27 years to get there or something. And at Los Alamos, they were working on a nanotube elevator to take people and supplies to space. And someone was talking about the prophecies of Isaiah. And Tammy Wynette was singing, "I wrecked the car and I was sad and so afraid that you'd be mad." And I drove through the town where Kit Carson penned up the Navajo with the Apaches, and the town where Billy the Kid shot two men and escaped through the chimney, and the town where Lew Wallace wrote Ben-Hur, and the place where the first atom bomb was tested, and I came to Roswell where those aliens came to Earth after the war. And on the same day, I think it was, or the day after, Wilson Pickett died. Nowhere else does it happen. Nowhere else could it happen, and certainly not in Portugal. There's another thing that happens in America, at least when you travel around on the surface, and I never see it here. You actually see in America sometimes grace, not bourgeois gentility or drugged serenity or states brought on by aromatherapy or sanctimony of any kind, but startling, tear-inducing, unself-conscious acts of grace that seem to be possible only when something primitive and childlike and raw is left in the culture. That's the thing about the US, it seems to me. Much that represents itself as unformed in the United States, in fact, goes to something much older and deeper than anything in the European countries. If you don't know what I mean by this grace, Marilyn Robinson's writing, I think, it comes out of that tradition, as does Willa Cather's Death Comes to the Archbishop. The United States is the only place on earth where my atheism sometimes wavers. And I can only think it is because in the United States, the meaning of life so often seems to be, as it was in the beginning, a religious meaning. We might wish for a new administration, a less hubristic foreign policy, a president who can utter a sentence and point to France on a map, or Austria on a map, after he's looked right through the Pacific and can't find it. A better healthcare system, fewer guns, fewer prisoners. In Montana, which is near Wyoming, but I don't know how many they've got in Wyoming, but I do know the great figure for Wyoming is 1 million people and 6 million guns. Fewer prisoners and much else that we associate with more developed countries. But it would be a horrible thing, I think, for the world if we woke up one morning and found that America was on a path to be like us. As for anti-Americanism, I grew up inspired by Davy Crockett, Groucho Marx, Louis Armstrong and Robert Mitchum. I was sorry I never grew a dimple like Robert Mitchum's. And by night, although people won't believe that I'm old enough, but I am, to remember Gloria Graham by Gloria Graham. She was the mystery in life, Gloria Graham, after seeing a B-grade movie when Lee Marvin threw a cup of hot, the Big Heat, threw hot coffee in her face when I was about 7 in the Poong Hall. And Marilyn Monroe, of course. And as their frontier was mine and their portraits of good and evil were mine, and as I thought of President Eisenhower in much the same fond way as I thought of my Uncle Herb, whom he very much resembled, and as this connection has only grown stronger as my life has proceeded, I believe I am half American, and therefore to be anti-American would be a form of self-loathing. So, oddly enough, I'm actually for loving America. It'll do it good. If we all love it. So long as we think of it as Nelson Algren thought of Chicago. He said it was like loving a woman with a broken nose. In fact, if we ever do join the Union, maybe that could be the motto of our joining in Latin beneath the flags of our two countries. I think I'll finish there and we'll have some questions if you're interested. Thank you.